People come to worship for many other reasons than simply to meet with God. As portrayed in the comic strip, One Big Happy Family, where Grandma and Ned are leaving church one day, and on the way out, she has a conversation with him, which I guess is not uncommon in male-female relationships. I know it's a little early in the service, but that'll come along. She says, lovely service, and he says, very nice. And she says, did you happen to see what Vanita was wearing? No. How about that ring on Odessa's finger? Didn't notice. Well, did you see who Carlos was with? No. In the rear pew. I didn't see him. And they stop walking. She looks at him and says, honestly, Nick, I don't even know why you go to church. Sometimes you might scratch your head and ask yourself the same question. Honestly, why am I really here? Did I come here today to interact with the God of the universe? Or did I come here for some other reason? In studying the life of David, we come to a very pivotal passage where we see David interacting with worship. And he comes to some very fundamental understandings that really are going to help us this morning. And I want you to just meditate for a moment before we dive into this passage on the contrast between David and Saul. Both men were anointed by God to be the king. And as Saul took the throne, Saul viewed God primarily as some kind of a talisman. Something that he could rub at certain times when he needed a military victory, and the genie would somehow pop out of the altar and provide him with what he needed to accomplish his goals and his priorities. You see, he relegated God to something less than who he was, even though he achieved the status of king because of God. David, on the other hand, had exactly the opposite attitude. When David comes to the throne, David is very committed to put God in his rightful place. And so once David conquers the city of Jerusalem, and he's the king over all of the kingdom, and he has his capital centrally located, what David wants to do more than anything else is make sure that his capital city is not simply the political center of the nation where he reigns as king. He wants to also make sure that it becomes the center of worship. He wants to make sure that everybody understands that God and God alone is the central focus of his kingdom. And in doing so, David learns two very important lessons about who God is and about worship in general. And if you'll open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 6, we're going to look at a great passage of Scripture this morning that really helps us see some incredible truths about worship and about God. The first truth that David is going to learn about worship, or the first lesson, is that when it comes to worship, every church ought to have a sign out in front of it that says, "Beware of God." Beware of God. You know, I'm afraid that oftentimes we come to worship not even really expecting or anticipating that God's going to show up. And many of us would be shocked if we really understood that God is here, present, interacting with every one of our thoughts, every one of our motives, every one of the things that we're wrestling with, every idea that floats through our mind, that God is speaking, and whether we're listening or not, God is present when we gather in His name and worship Him. And David is going to learn that when it comes to God, we cannot trivialize with Him. We must make sure that we treat Him as God. And if we don't, He's dangerous. He's not very safe. I want you to see in the passage in chapter 6, starting in verse 1, it says, David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baal of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the Ark. Now, first of all, let me just say a word about the Ark. This is the Ark of the Covenant that God told Moses to make back in the wilderness. And this Ark was basically a box that was inlaid and overlaid with gold. And on top of the box was a place called the mercy seat. And that place on top of the box was also covered by two cherubim, two angels that faced each other and were mounted on the top. And all of this was the most holy article in all of Israel's worship. It sat in a special place behind a veil in the tabernacle, and it was considered the place where God actually made contact with his people. Now, God is completely holy, and everything in the world in which we live has been tainted by sin, and so God's presence can't literally come and interact with people, can't literally come and touch down, and this ark was symbolic of the fact that God came and met with the people, and every year on the Day of Atonement, the priest would come in with blood, and he would sprinkle it on top of the mercy seat to place a covering of blood there. A sacrifice, and that was the place that God's presence would come and meet and touch down. And the cherubim symbolized the guardians of God's holiness. So when you looked at the Ark of the Covenant, this was the place, the literal place, where Israel expected to meet God face to face, to worship Him, the most holy of all the articles found in the tabernacle. Now let me give you a little history lesson. The ark was stationed at Shiloh along with the tabernacle when Eli was the priest and Samuel was the little boy growing up there. And the nation of Israel was under heavy attack from the Philistines and they were getting whipped up on badly. And so they thought, well, let's go get the ark and let's bring it into battle, because if we bring God's presence into battle, surely we will win. But because of the people's continued rebellion and disobedience, not only did they lose the battle, but they also lost the ark. And in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel, the Philistines capture the ark, much to their own personal dismay, because you know what happens? First thing they do is they take it to their city, they place it in front of their god, and they come in the next morning and their god is face down. Their idol is laying on the floor in front of the ark. Then all kinds of bad things start to happen. They start having all kinds of health problems. People start getting sick. People start dying. And so they move it from city to city to three different Philistine cities. And finally, the last city says, hey, we can't take this. This is too dangerous. And so they put it on a new ox cart that they build. They put two oxen in front of it, set it on there, and say, let it go wherever it will. And you know what it does? It turns and it heads up to the land of Israel. In fact, it goes to the city of Beth Shemesh. When it gets there, the people rejoice because the ark is there, but they rejoice too long, because 70 of the men decide that they're going to look into the ark. So they open it to look in, and God kills all 70 of them. So they believe that this is too dangerous to keep with them. So they send it on, and it eventually lands in Kiriath Jearim, which is the place that David's going to get it from. And it has been sitting there for over 60 years. Sitting there in this one man, this one priest's house, it's been there for 60 years. And David says, I want the ark, the presence of God, to be in the place where I rule. So he's going to get it. And you noticed in verse 1, he pulled together 30,000 soldiers, chosen elite soldiers. Verse 3 says, they set the ark of God on a new cart, and they brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. Now this is some kind of a procession. You got the ark sitting on an ox cart being hauled along. You got the two sons of the priest who's been watching it, one going in front of it, one walking beside it. You've got 30,000 soldiers marching in procession alongside of it, not to mention all the priests, all the Levites, all the nation of Israel, and we've got ourselves a real marching band. The text tells us that there were lyres and harps. Those would be stringed instruments that were being played. We find out from a parallel passage in 1 Chronicles that they had trumpets there. In addition to that, they had three rhythm instruments. They had cymbals. They had sistrums, which were shakers that basically made a shaking sound. And also, they had tambourines, and the people are marching, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and they're praising God, and they're having just this incredible processional, one of the greatest days in history as far as David's concerned, and things are going just great. The people are having a party as they bring God's presence into the city of Jerusalem, but it doesn't last long. Notice what happens in verse 6. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. God sure knows how to ruin a good party. Like, they're in procession, they're going up, everything's going great. They're coming along, they get to a place where the road is rough, the oxen start to stumble, the cart starts to tip. Uzzah reaches his hand out, puts his hand on the ark to steady the ark, and all of a sudden he's dead. Now the text doesn't tell us how he died, but I would imagine it was dramatic. I mean, let's face it, we've got probably 50,000 people in procession here, making all kinds of noise. How would they even know if he just kind of crumpled up and fell to his knees? How would they even know what happened? See, I think that we have a little bit of a precedent for this. If you'll remember back to Leviticus chapter 10, when Nadab and Abihu were offering strange incense before the Lord, and it said that fire came out of the sanctuary and consumed them. And I would imagine that whatever God did was dramatic, was visible, but whatever it did, we've got a dead priest laying beside the ark, and it stops the party. Everybody shuts up. Everybody's quiet. And I want you to see David's reaction. David's reaction is very strong. It says, verse 8, then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah, which means outbreak against Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, how can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now, you might say, what in the world's going on here? Like, why did God kill Uzzah for trying to help out here? Well, we have to go back to Numbers chapter 4, verse 15 to find out. Let me just read it for you. In Numbers 4, chapter 4, verse 15, we're told that after Aaron and the sons had finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, and when the camp is ready to move, the Kohathites are to come and do the carrying, but they must not touch the holy things or what? Or they will die. The Kohathites are to carry those things that are in the tent of the meeting. In 1 Chronicles chapter 15, verse 13, looking back on the incident, David says, it was because you, the Levites, did not bring up the first time the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. We did not inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way. In other words, God had told them that there is a way to take the ark and carry it, and they were not doing it that way, and that made God mad because they were not treating him with respect. And so when Uzzah reached out and touched the ark, which was a violation of God's command, God killed him there on the spot. Party or no party, celebration or no celebration, intentions, good intentions or no intentions, God said, here's what I want. They didn't do it that way, and God stepped in and took the life of one of the priests and did it in front of everybody. And David just completely loses it. I think it's interesting. He gets angry, and then he gets scared. He gets angry, God, you know, I'm just trying to serve you. I'm just trying to make you look good. I'm just trying to bring you to Jerusalem. Oh, God, who am I dealing with here? Who do I think I am? Do I think I can do good things for you doing it my way? Or do I need to recognize that you and you alone are the one who makes the rules? You and you alone are the one who is to be respected. And David becomes afraid and he refuses to bring the ark up. David learns a lesson. You got to beware of God. God is not someone to be trifled with. David also learns a second lesson through this experience, and the second lesson is you got to beware of people. And we ought to have a sign out in front of every church. Right next to the one that says beware of God, the second sign is to beware of people. Notice what happens starting in verse 12. After David finds out that the Lord is blessing the house of Obed-Edom, the king was told, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God. So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And he gets it right this time. Verse 13 says, when those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. They take six steps. He stops and makes an offering there. The text isn't exactly clear, but this may be, when you correlate it with 1 Chronicles, it may be that every six steps they stopped and offered a sacrifice. In other words, David wants to make sure that not only do they carry it in the right way, but that God knows all the way along the way that they're doing this for him. This is all about him and not about them. Goes on to say, David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and with the sound of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of the Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. And then David went to his home, verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. When Michal looked down and saw David dancing, she saw David acting like a commoner. Now remember, she's the daughter of the king. And rather than David being sitting in his skybox, as dignitaries would tend to do, and give a nod to the procession as it passed by, or rather than David wearing his kingly robes and his crown and making sure everybody knew that he was not like the rest of them, David put on the clothing of a priest, and he got out there and he mixed it up with the people and he danced and he celebrated and he praised God. And here was this girl that was raised in royalty, the daughter of Saul, looks down on him and she is disgusted with his behavior. "David, you're acting like a complete average person. Don't you understand what you're doing?" I want you to notice her words. What she says to him is very stinging. And by the way, just a word to the wise wives. If your husband ever comes home from a victory, that's not the time to bring up something to criticize him about. It's interesting here. David is coming home to bless his house. He stood up in public. The nation of Israel applauded him. He's done a great thing for God. Everybody loves him, and he walks in the door, and the first words out of his wife were, "You sorry idiot." And for those of you who are married, ask your husbands how that feels. You leave the job where everybody thinks that you're great, and you walk into the house, and you hear how sorry you are, and the tendency is, "Well, I'm going back to work. See you all later." She hits David at the door. Notice what she says. Notice her words. She says to David in Well, it's verse 20 here. She says, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today. How you've made yourself look good. She says, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of the servant as any vulgar fellow would. The word disrobe is used three times in the Hebrew. Disrobing as any vulgar fellow would disrobe himself is literally what she says. He's not disrobing himself by being naked. He's disrobing himself by laying aside his kingly clothes and acting like an average person. And that is disgusting to her. She says, you need to act like a king. And David's response is, listen, I'm doing this for God, not for you, not for the people, not for anybody. I'm celebrating for God. I'm worshiping for him. And he goes on to say in verse 22, I will become even more undignified than this for God, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. And then he says, but by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. And you know what's interesting? That's one of the key principles of leadership. As long as a leader sits up above everybody else and looks down his nose at people, people will not respect him or her. But when a leader is actually willing to get their hands, their sleeves rolled up and get their hands dirty, investing themselves in the cause that the people are working for and the people are fighting for, you know what? That builds respect. And Michael doesn't understand this because Saul, her daddy, won his respect standing there with his spear in his hand all of the time. So David learns the second lesson about worship, and that is that there will be people who will, if they can, try to stifle your enthusiasm for God by criticizing you for your passion and your energy and what you believe you want to communicate to God in worship. Now, having looked at the story, I want to apply this in four specific ways because I think there are things here that are just so important for us to grasp. First of all, when it comes to God, don't ever assume you're untouchable. When it comes to God, don't ever assume that you're untouchable. See, I'm not exactly sure what's in Uzzah's heart and mind. We don't know. But we do know that he grew up with the ark in his home. He grew up with the ark in his home. We also know that Uzzah was of the priestly family. And so he and his father should have known that there is a prescribed way to carry the ark and there's a way not to. And what they opted to do was use the latest Philistine technology rather than the old-fashioned hard way of getting the right people and actually carrying the ark in the way it was prescribed and supposedly carried. And I just wonder, when that ark started to slide and Uzzah reached out his hand to touch the ark, I wonder if it ever crossed his mind. You know, this could be bad. God said, don't do this. Or I wonder if he just kind of assumed, you know, I'm a priest. I'm in charge of this thing. I've been around this my whole life. I'm taking care of it. I'm doing my part. And came to the point of believing that he was untouchable. I believe David certainly thought that. David certainly thought, you know, I'm doing a good thing for God. Nothing bad could ever go wrong on this day. And I think it's dangerous that when we assume, for whatever reason, maybe it's because you've been a Christian for a long time, maybe it's because you worship regularly, maybe it's because you read your Bible, when you assume that you could never do anything that was offensive to God, when you assume that God's judgment could never come in your life, you begin to think you're untouchable. You begin to think that you're above God, and that's a dangerous place to be. Here's a guy that lived with the ark in his home, and yet he died by touching the ark. You see, he made one fatal mistake, and that was this. Somehow in his mind, he believed that his hand was more holy than the dust of the ground that God created. Somehow he believed that his hand was more pure, even though it was connected to a human heart, than if that ark would have fallen to the ground. And you know what? God doesn't look at it that way. God doesn't see it that way. Don't ever come to a point where you believe that you're untouchable, that God's judgment would never come on you, because that's a risky place to live. Second principle in this passage is that when it comes to God, always sweat the small stuff. When it comes to God, We need to always sweat the small stuff. Now, I know some people just wear others out because they sweat the small stuff as a matter of course. It's their way of controlling the world. But there is a time and a place to pay attention to detail. And paying attention to detail communicates something very important, and it communicates the significance of whatever the detail is. For example, when it comes time to put together a wedding ceremony, desiring to have everything look right, having the flowers right, the music right, the words right, the decorations right, the dress right, the time right, the invitations right. You know what all that's saying? What all that's saying is this is such an important event, it's so significant that we're going to put the extra time, effort, and energy into making sure that it goes well, making sure that it looks good, making sure that it's right. That's saying something significant about marriage. When it comes to God, when we ignore what He says, in little ways or in big ways, what we're saying is, God, you're not that important. And I know that oftentimes believers are very comfortable harboring what they perceive to be small sins in their life. You know, I haven't committed the dirty dozen. You know, I hadn't broken any of the big ones. And so therefore, my apathy, therefore my ill treatment of people, therefore my hidden anger or my pride, you know, those are okay. I can live with that. That's okay. It's not that big of a deal. It doesn't seem to affect that many people. I can live with that. What you're doing is you're saying, God is not that important. When it comes to God, the things of God are very, very significant. One of the things that stands out so much in this passage is that there are many people who, when it comes to the worship of God, think it's simply a party. It's a celebration. It has nothing to do with His reverence, with His holiness, with His awesomeness. And you know what? Most of us could use a healthy dose of fear, because God is not someone to be trivial with. God is someone who is awesome and holy. And we need to sweat the small stuff when it comes to our worship of God. When your surgeon pulls the scalpel out, you want him to sweat the small stuff. Because it's critical to your survival. And when you come into the presence of God, do you come paying attention? I'd like us to bow our heads. I'd like us to spend a few moments reflecting on our attitude toward God. As you bow your heads, I want you to just to begin to reflect on your attitude toward God. Have you gotten so comfortable with God? Has He become so familiar to you that you have a very casual attitude about your own personal life, about your holiness, about the way you approach Him in worship? Do you view God more as a buddy than you do as your sovereign Lord, creator of the universe? Let's spend a few moments just meditating together and thinking about our view of this awesome God. I hope that as you grow in your understanding of who God is, that you grow in your understanding of His awesome power, that He is very, very serious about His holiness. And when we worship Him and we live our lives in accordance with His will, we're on track. We have hope. We have help. When we mess with Him and ignore Him and slough Him off, we're in risky territory. Our feet are firmly planted in quicksand, because God is not someone to be trivialized with. David learned a lesson. Uzzah learned a lesson. Can you imagine Uzzah's conversation 3 seconds after he touched the ark? And he was standing face to face with the one who brought him to heaven. And God said, "Don't mess with me." David also learned a very important lesson about celebrating. And that is that complete obedience creates complete freedom in worship. I want you to notice something very significant in this passage. When we see what happened the first time when David was bringing the ark, the time that failed, I want you to notice the word that is used there. It says in verse 5 that David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might. There's a different word used when David brings the ark successfully the second time, and we see that word in verse 12, where it says that, "So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing." See, the first time, they were having a party. It was really about them. It was about what they were doing for God. But once they got it right, once they knew that they were doing it in the way that was pleasing God, the tone changed from a focus on celebration, simply having a good time at what we're doing for God, to a time of really rejoicing in that we are pleasing God. And when our lives truly take on the characteristic of obedience, when we're sweating the small stuff, when we're paying attention to how well we're living, and we're giving ourselves completely to God, when we do that, there's a difference in our worship. It frees us up to truly give our hearts, to truly give our praise, to truly give our expression to God. I liken it to a child who knows that he or she has really continued to walk on shaky ground in obedience to mom and dad. And there's always this kind of fear of retribution. There's fear of being found out. In fact, oftentimes the relationship tends to drift because the child would rather stay out of mom and dad's presence than move into mom and dad's presence because there's not complete obedience. There's not compliance. And the same thing is true in our worship. Oftentimes when we feel a distance from God, when we're not excited about prayer, when we're not excited about spending time in the Word, when we're not excited about coming to worship, the real issue is there's something in our hearts that's wrong. And so we feel uncomfortable coming face to face with God. But when we live in obedience, we want to be near. We want to run to Him. We want to worship Him. We want to be in His presence. And obedience gives an incredible freedom. When David was doing it right, they still had a party. They were still dancing and singing, but there was a qualitative difference. They had freedom in worship. The final principle that we see in this passage is that we forfeit blessings when we discourage enthusiasm in worship. We forfeit blessings when we discourage enthusiasm in worship. I mean, David's dancing before the Lord, and it says he's dancing with all of his might, and it says he's leaping and jumping around. You know, we say, well, that was, you know, those guys were a lot more expressive back then, different culture, different place, and, you know, it is true that we tend to be a little bit more reserved, but, you know, I know that some of you are going to just jump up and down and scream and holler and give high fives when the San Antonio Spurs win the world championship. Some of you guys that are very reserved are going to do that. And some of you ladies who don't really like basketball are going to jump up and down when the series is over. You're just going to be happy. It's going to be a great time. You know, when your group gets picked for the next new project and everybody meets outside the cubicle and goes, "Yeah, they finally recognized us. They're finally giving us our credit." You know, that's a similar feeling, a similar expression. David is so excited about bringing the ark that he's literally dancing and jumping around and singing and slapping people on the back. And, you know, I don't know if they did high fives back then, but I mean, they're excited. They're having a great time. And somebody's standing at the window watching it and saying, "You know, that's pretty undignified, David. You're just making a fool of yourself." You know what David says? David says, "If I have to make a fool out of myself to express how excited I am about God, then I'm happy to do that and more." And I think that this is just an incredible passage of scripture, because there are two types of people I see in worship. There's the type of people that believe that, you know, God's just a party guy. And so, you know, when we come together, we clap, dance, sing, and, you know, who cares about getting it right? Because God's not someone to be reverent around. God's someone to be happy around. So let's not worry about whether we honor him. Let's just have fun, because God's all about fun, right? And that group of people tend to look down on anybody that is stiff or anybody who really focuses on God's reverence and say, you know, you guys are all stodgy and stuck in the mud. And then there's a group of people that are on the other side, and they see people getting excited in worship, and they say, you know what we really need? We need a little more reverence around here. We need people to be more quiet. We need people to be more reserved, because God is holy, and holiness to me means, you know, down on my knees in a posture where I keep my mouth shut and I'm very, very quiet in his presence. And there's a time to be quiet in his presence. But you know what this passage is telling us? This passage is telling us that both of those attitudes are wrong. Both of those attitudes are wrong. What we need are people that truly understand who God is and worship him in reverence and do things his way. And when they do that, they break loose and they sing and they dance and they clap and they enjoy God, because God is not someone that simply wants our quiet, reserved stoicism. God also wants our joy, our celebration, our happiness. And I guess my question to you is, when was the last time you got so excited about who God is that you did something out of character? When was the last time? Now, out of character for you might be to smile. So I'm not suggesting that you come dancing down the aisle. That's not what I'm suggesting. When was the last time you were so caught up in your joy and enjoyment of God that you just almost couldn't control yourself, and you got out of character? See, that's what David was doing, and Michael looked down and she said, David, you're out of character. You're the king. Kings don't act like that. And David said, I'm not the king. I'm the head worshiper, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to express my joy to God. And you know what happens to Michael? She does not have a child. We don't know why. We don't know if that means that David no longer lived with her. We don't know if God closed up her womb. But we know that she is so concerned about wanting him to be kingly, because she's the daughter of a king, that she does not have the opportunity to make sure that there's an heir to her father for the future throne. She forfeits kingship and her claim to kingship because she places God below the king. And any time in our kingdom that we put God at that level, we don't celebrate him, we're missing what God's calling us to. What we ought to be is we ought to be so careful and cautious that we want to make sure that in every way that we honor God with reverence by obeying him. And out of that ought to flow such incredible, enthusiastic worship that when people see us talking about our God, singing about our God, serving our God, worshiping our God, they ought to go, whoa, that's different. Because our best is presented to our King. Let's bow our heads for prayer. And as we do, I want you to search your heart. You fall into one of those two extremes, may God reveal that to us this morning. Father, as we come before you, we just say, shake us a little bit, open our minds, change our attitude. Father, we don't want to be stuck in the same old rut. And as David was such an example of someone who understood you and knew you and enjoyed you fully, may we be men and women and children who enjoy you as well. May our lives take on a renewed character. For those who struggle with seeing you in a serious light, I pray that you would burn into their hearts your holiness. And for those who struggle with seeing you in a joyous way, I pray that you would fill them up with an enthusiasm that would overflow. Father, you're worthy of it all. We praise you in the powerful name, Jesus Christ. Amen.